Good morning. It's time for In the Green Outdoors with Gail Martin and Carol Kelly. Each week, the ladies will bring you gardening and planting ideas, tell you about native Ohio plants, prairies and habitats, and great tips for everything in the green outdoors. This week with Carol Kelly.
Hello again, everyone. How many listeners were surprised to awaken to freshly fallen snow last Monday, April 7th? Of course, by mid-morning, with the sun rising in a suddenly clearing sky, it all had melted, aside from that still lingering in shaded areas. But just remember, on April 21st, in 2021, we had about 2 or 3 inches of that white stuff, so don't be too hasty putting new plants into the ground just yet, no matter how tempting are the displays at the grocery stores and the garden centers. Despite the bizarre ups and downs, nature marches to her own long-established schedule. Many kinds of trees have been flowering for the last couple of weeks, including the now-banned-for-sale Callery Pear, whose white flowers announce the tree's increasing presence along roadsides and meadows, descendants of trees that line city streets and those that grow in many city and rural yards. If you've been noticing a particular stench this past week while walking from the parking lot of the Merriam Public Library into the building, you can thank the flowers of the big Callery Pear trees that are planted there. In addition to that invasive species, woodland edges and understories once more are densely green as the leaves of the widely present invasive honeysuckle rapidly expands with new growth, shading the forest floor. This species is one of a number of invasives responsible for the disappearance of so many of our beautiful spring ephemeral wildflowers. Those have disappeared from many of our woodlands since the early spring sunlight that triggers their growth no longer can reach the forest floor. On a happier note, native redbud trees soon will be covered in masses of bright pink flowers. If you have one of these trees near you, perhaps you've noticed that the flowers not only dangle from the ends of twigs and branches, but even may sprout in tight, stemless clusters directly from the trunk or branches, especially on older trees. According to the Virginia Native Plant Society and Michael Durr, who's the author of the Manual of Woody Landscape Plants, this odd arrangement is a normal growth characteristic of redbud trees and has a perfectly apt name to go with it, cauliflory, a word that recalls the vegetable that the tightly packed redbud clusters resemble. You also should know that the flowers, and later the young, flat, immature seed pods that resemble baby snow pea pods, are edible. I pluck and nibble some right from the tree when working in the yard in spring, and then gather more to add later to salads. While we welcome the blossoms of numerous trees and flowers of spring, there's a class of plants that we are not so glad to see. Let's take a brief look at just a few of the most common of these that are present in our landscapes now, or will be very soon. Driving around the rural parts of Marion and neighboring counties recently, you may have noticed potential corn and soybean fields covered in a vegetative sea of purple. The plants responsible are commonly known as dead nettle, the name referring to the fact that, unlike true nettles, which they superficially resemble, they have no sting. And they also belong to the mint family, a different plant family entirely than stinging nettles. But the dead nettles have no minty scent. Dead nettle may be present in such profusion each spring that they seem to be perennial, but actually they're one of many winter annuals that produce seed in great quantities. The term winter annual is applied to the class of weeds whose seeds germinate and form inconspicuous leaves in late summer to early fall. Members of this sneaky group of weeds quickly resume growth in late winter, then flower and produce new seeds before quickly fading away in late spring, out of sight, out of mind. That new crop of seeds remains in the soil dormant, though, and since they do not germinate until autumn, they're immune to spring-applied pre-emergent herbicides. It's important to be on the lookout for and deal with this category of weeds before they bloom. dead nettle isn't much of a problem for farmers who plow in the spring because the entire plants are plowed under and die. But the multitudes of early appearing purple flowers do feed vast numbers of hungry bees, and really, this shallow-rooted plant is easily pulled from soft, moist garden soil. So if you choose to ignore their value to the bees, uproot them. Otherwise, please leave them there. Many people have difficulty distinguishing between the closely related purple dead nettle, which is Lamium purpureum, and henbit, Lamium amplexicol, another very common field and garden weed. The closely arranged, drooping, triangular to heart-shaped leaves on the stiff stems of dead nettle make plants look like miniature pagodas. Henbit, on the other hand, has scalloped leaves that encircle its weaker stems at intervals. Both plants have the square stems, opposite leaves, and flowers, typical of the mint or Lamiaceae family. Many people grow the perennial spotted dead nettle and other cultivated varieties of Lamium as ground covers, some of which have silvery, variegated leaves. All of these perennials are Eurasian in origin and arrived in North America centuries ago. In a couple of weeks, the fields of purple dead nettle may well give way to a taller plant called butterweed. The upright, 2 or 3 foot tall plants that appear in Ohio landscapes present a weed management challenge. Also known as crestleaf groundsel, this member of the aster family produces loose clusters of bright yellow, daisy-like flowers, followed by seed heads that look like miniature dandelion puffballs. The erect, hollow stems are green with reddish-purple streaks, and the crest-like leaves are responsible for the common name. For reasons not clearly understood, this annual native plant has become unusually common in Ohio in recent years in cultivated fields, nurseries, and landscapes. Various reports indicate that the weed may have some tolerance to 2,4-D and may require high rates of glyphosate if it's to be controlled. Of course, if butterweed appears in your yard, as it does in mine, as the herbal mystery author Susan Wittig Albert has pointed out, one person's weed is another person's wildflower. And, indeed, patches of this winter annual are quite attractive, not only visually to humans, but also to a variety of pollinators. If unwanted, however, butterweed, too, may be pulled very easily from damp soil before seeds form. Just be sure to put the flower or seed heads into a trash bag right after pulling to avoid a new generation. Plants left on the ground to wilt still may ripen their seeds. Cardamine hirsuta, commonly called hairy bittercress or popping cress, is an annual or biennial species of plant in the Brassicaceae or mustard family. As such, it is edible as a salad green with a flavor not unlike watercress. By now, though, much of it already has bloomed, and simply brushing against the stalks will send the tiny seeds to explode off and land several feet from the parent plant. Even a stiff breeze may release the seeds. Like the other plants I just have talked about, it has a shallow root system, easily pulled from damp soil. But this needed to be done about a month ago, before the seeds ripened. While it's too early for many domesticated plants to go in ground, the hardy winter weeds laugh at our crazy weather, so the gardener must be vigilant. Speaking of plants that arrive from far afield, you may recall that back in early February, when I was describing the various techniques for regrowing vegetable plants from discarded vegetable parts, I spoke of the sweet potato vine that I have growing in my southeast-facing bay window. I read an interesting discussion of the origin of sweet potatoes in a book by Stefano Mancuso, titled The Incredible Journey of Plants. As the title implies, the author explores the many fascinating paths and journeys that numerous plants have made over centuries. Explorer Thor Heyerdahl thought that sweet potatoes originated in the islands of Polynesia. However, as author Mancuso points out, there are records of South American farmers having cultivated sweet potatoes from at least the year 2000 BCE. If you have the room to grow them, not only are sweet potatoes a very healthy addition to one's diet, they are very productive in the garden and offer double value. Unlike regular potatoes, the foliage of which is not edible, Sweet potatoes are true vining plants that yield a lot of edible and nutritious green leaves and shoots all summer long, in addition to the wonderful potatoes in late fall. The plants are carefree when it comes to pests and disease. Sweet potato vines do tend to sprawl over a large area, but while they won't support themselves by twining around a support, as does the ornamental morning glory vine, a trellis can help sweet potato vines grow vertically and make it easier to harvest the leaves. Weaving the vines through a trellis also will prevent them from commandeering too much garden area. As the vines grow, they may produce some morning glory-looking flowers, since sweet potatoes do belong to the same genus as those garden flowers. It is of utmost importance to note at this point, however, that even though the two plants are related, common morning glory definitely is not edible, and eating any part of this ornamental plant brings dangerous health risks. Not only can ingesting any flowers or foliage produce hallucinations and other neurological problems, gastronomical distress, including nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, can occur and lead to dehydration. Worse yet, cardiovascular symptoms may arise, with the possibility of increased heart rate and changes in blood pressure. By the way, while we refer often to both regular and sweet potatoes as tubers, botanically there is a slight difference between the two. Both regular potatoes and sweet potatoes produce underground fleshy structures that perform the functions both of food storage and the potential for vegetative reproduction. They differ in origin, however. That is, the sweet potato is a swollen adventitious root, while the potato tuber is an underground stem. Sweet potatoes left in the ground after the vines have died back may rot in wet weather, so it's best to harvest these before it rains for an extended period, and always before a hard frost. Freezing temperatures kill the leaves, as well can damage the roots and significantly reduce your harvest. Well, that's it for this week. This is Carol Kelly, urging you to be patient, enjoy the daffodils and tulips, and keep pulling weeds until it's time to plant the plants that you wish to grow here in the green outdoors.
And there's your show for the week. In the Green Outdoors is a production of WZMO Radio. The show airs Saturdays and Mondays right after the second cup at about 9:30 a.m. If you have a question or comment for Carol or Gail, you can email it to WZMO@roadrunner.com. Thank you for listening.